welcome to the Unseen and Chapman podcast on The Athletic. As usual, we bring you exclusive insight and stories from our team of writers. And coming up today, we'll discuss some of the stories from David's weekly column, including the strange case of William Saliba, one of the many issues surrounding Arsenal's poor start to this season. The Athletic's Laurie Whitwell will join us with plenty of detail on Paul Pogba's time at Manchester United and what might happen next. And our German writer, Rafa Honigstein, will be with us to discuss the future of Leipzig's Dayo Upamecano and his exclusive interview with Bayern Munich's Leon Goretzka. Read all the articles we discuss on today's podcast in full over on The Athletic. Right now, if you subscribe to The Athletic, you can give another subscription as a gift for free. It's the perfect present for any football fan this Christmas. You get all the great analysis and the in-depth features from the very best football writers around, plus ad-free versions of all our podcasts. It is the perfect present for yourself and someone else. Basically, you buy it for yourself, give the freebie to someone else. Just go to theathletic.com/Ornstein and Chapman. And I'm back on this podcast feed on Thursday alongside Matt Slater for our new podcast, The Business of Sport. So, David, we'll get to your column in a minute. But this time last year, much of your writing on The Athletic and much of your talking on this podcast featured really exclusive detail on the sacking of Unai Emery and the succession plan that saw Mikel Arteta appointed. It's been a busy year, hasn't it, since then for Arsenal's writers at The Athletic. Arteta's arrival hasn't necessarily calmed at times the circus that is around the club. I mean, we've had exclusives on everything from Gunnosaurus to your interview with Mesut Ozil.
Yeah, it's been a tumultuous roller coaster year for Arsenal, like it has for many clubs. They don't need to be singled out in that sense, especially with the COVID pandemic. But yeah, if you think back to this time last year, Arteta came in. Arsenal were facing all sorts of problems on and off the pitch. Freddie Ljungberg had taken interim control and lifted the mood around the place a bit, but many of the underlying issues needed resolving long term, and I still don't think many of them have. That's a work in progress, and it's going to take a long time. We can touch upon some of those issues in greater depth. He got off to a decent start, Mikel Arteta, and then COVID hit. You'll remember that it was his positive diagnosis that led to football going into shutdown, and goodness me, all manner of difficulties then cropped up for Arsenal, from player wage cut negotiations. Arsenal were the only Premier League club to take cuts in the end. There were staff changes at board level. There were redundancies en masse. There was a decimation of the scouting department, as some have described it. There were contractual issues for David Luiz, Pablo Mari, Cedric Suarez that sort of bubbled over around the time of Arsenal's defeat at Manchester City. Project Restart, I think it was June the 17th. Luiz gave an emotional interview after the match that hinted at the sort of problems bubbling away beneath the surface inside the club. At the same time, Arsenal were trying to secure the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang contract extension. I think he came really close to signing just before Raul Sanlehi left. He didn't end up signing until a month later, by which point the new season had already started. The Mesut Ozil controversy rumbled away. That was to nobody's benefit. A real blight, I feel, on everybody involved. The reputation of the club, matters on and off the pitch, just totally unedifying. William Saliba's mess, you could call it, and we'll come on to talk about that. Even lower down the chain at youth level, bit of a contract dilemma, standoff, call it what you like, with Follerin Balogun, the talented young player who many Arsenal fans and people within the game have high hopes for. Arsenal will hope to solve that now, but it gives you an indication of the absolute tornado of problems, dilemmas, headaches, issues that have been going on at the club. And we could talk further about board level issues and you know, staff changes and disruption that you've got to think at some point start to seep through to matters on the field. Now, we don't know, and there are many issues involved in football results, but certainly it wasn't conducive to success. These topics involve many of the players, and I tend to feel that it will eventually have an effect on matters. To what extent, we don't know, but it's been a really unpleasant time for the club, and they'll hope to come out of it as soon as possible.
All right, I'll come on to the players, come on to the squad in just a minute. Just look at the executive structure, really, that Arteta is now working with and how that has maybe changed for him and probably helped him.
It's helped increase his power base, but I don't think it's helped him in terms of his work and his hopes of succeeding. I still, and many others still, think that he will succeed at Arsenal and beyond that in management full stop. But the way things are there at the moment do not look conducive to success for now, and a lot needs to change if that's going to happen. Arsenal have changed structurally and at executive level more than any other club I can think of in the entire Premier League in the last few years. From the structural changes that Ivan Gazidis brought about, putting numerous heads of department in place in a continental style model that eventually led to the departure of Arsene Wenger and a head coach installed in Unai Emery. That seemed to be the way for a little bit. And then people started to leave. The head of recruitment, Sven Mislintat, they went a slightly different route with dual heads, almost like double chief executives in Vinay Venkatesham, more on the business side, Raul Sanlehi, more on the football side. Then that gets scrapped when Raul Sanlehi departs as head of football, with a lot of speculation over the reasons, which we've not ever truly heard about. Then Hus Fahmy, the person responsible for contracts, the director of football operations, he leaves as well. Was that related to the Sanlehi departure, or was that more just his decision to leave? And if it was his decision, why did he leave? Suddenly, this structure that Gazidis has put in place to get away from the all-powerful manager that Arsene Wenger's era symbolised has been torn to pieces, and they've gone back the other way to the all-powerful head coach, who's now no longer the head coach. He's now the first team manager in Mikel Arteta, a promotion in title that I think he was enthusiastic about when offered the opportunity. And the club, Tim Lewis, the non-executive director brought in by the Kroenkes, who very much seems to have executive powers, and he certainly has the ear of the Kroenkes, supported it. The Kroenkes supported it. And that means it's Mikel Arteta and Edu as technical director responsible for everything on the football side, with some people saying, who is the boss? Is it Edu managing Mikel Arteta, which it should be as technical director in this kind of model? Or now that Arteta's been promoted to manager, is it him managing Edu, which could, of course, be worrying? He's in his first year as a number one, and he suddenly got the responsibility of a traditional manager, which comes with recruitment power, which comes with organisational power, with coaching responsibilities. Many I speak to think that was the worst decision Arsenal could have made, and he just needs to focus on the coaching and let other people do the rest. Meanwhile, Edu, who many say he's impressive, but he's very new to the role. He had previously worked at the Brazil national team and in Corinthians, so not in the UK, not in the European game or transfer market, so it's going to be a quicker acclimatization process for him. They've got rid of, as I said, a load of scouts, and so they're relying on a new model, and that's it. They need to bring in somebody to do the contracts now that Hus Fahmy's gone, and he was heavily influential in a lot of the football activity that Arsenal were doing. And they've got Vinay Venkatesham, as I said, on the business side, the chief executive, kind of the figurehead to lead the club forward operationally, and Tim Lewis, as mentioned as well. So it's a very, very complex picture at Arsenal at the moment, and whatever's happening, it's not going well. Arteta has the backing of the Arsenal hierarchy. They believe in his project long term, and of course, nobody's going to be happy with where things are going, but they are behind him. And from a personal perspective, I do think that's the right decision. Chopping and changing the manager yet again is not going to guarantee anything. It's probably about time we started looking at some other reasons.
Such as Amy Lawrence has written today for The Athletic, Arteta has to stop rewarding experienced players for bad performances.
Yeah, there's a huge conversation among Arsenal fans. For example, when you watch them in Europa League, and I know it's difficult to compare the Europa League to the Premier League, but you see a lot of hunger. You see a lot of young players who have come through the academy, or fringe players who haven't had the chance in the Premier League, who are playing with vigour and enthusiasm and exuberance. And then we don't see any of them in a Premier League match day. Mikel Arteta goes back to the tried and trusted, the experienced players who are underperforming chronically in many cases and appear not to deserve to be given the trust that they are being given.
I mean, it is a difficult comparison, what you do against Dundalk as opposed to Burnley at home.
Totally, but it couldn't be going much worse for those who are getting repeated opportunities. There is a feeling, as Amy talks about much more eloquently than me in her piece, that there needs to be a little bit of a shift up in personnel. January is going to be a very interesting time. The Mesut Ozil question keeps coming back to me and many others. I don't see Arsenal changing tack on that. I don't see Mikel Arteta shifting his stance. Mesut Ozil has been training with the first team, but if you think about Arsenal's schedule, playing two matches a week every 3 days, no club doing that is going to be training properly at the full intensity. And when they are together as a group, outside of travel to and from matches and recovery, those sessions are going to be used to prepare the first team for the next match. And therefore, players like Mesut Ozil will only be used on the opposition. They're not ready for first team action. And that's nobody's fault, really. But besides that, the politics around it, the reasons that Mikel Arteta's not picking him, they say football reasons, he's completely backed by the club's hierarchy and ownership in leaving Mesut Ozil out. I don't see, personally, him bringing Ozil back in January. What I do see is Arsenal trying to make a signing of a creative player. And we know they've got an interest because we've talked about Dominic Szoboszlai. There have been reports that he has opted to join RB Leipzig, which wouldn't surprise anybody given the path from Salzburg to Leipzig. But personally, I've not heard that. And very recently, I've heard that Arsenal still are interested in him, but they do have reservations, which is understandable for a player of his age and stage of development. And those reservations are outlined in a piece on The Athletic by Tom Warville. Sorry to Arsenal fans to say this, but as I hear it, if Arsenal are to bring him in, he's not ready to start every single game. He's not going to be some silver bullet to solve all of their problems if they were to bring him in. They do have other options. I do not believe that they want to pursue the signing of Christian Eriksen, as has been reported in some quarters, but there are possibilities that they would have ideally liked to sort of activate in the summer when Ozil leaves, but things aren't working out well. And I do think they'll try to do that in January because the lack of creativity is stark. But back to the fundamental point of what you asked, I actually think the biggest issue is not to go through one by one players, but look at the culture. When we did a big piece on the Kroenkes recently that you can read on The Athletic, we explored why there were the executive changes, the departure of Rouse and Leahy. There was a lot of speculation over transfers, etc. And perhaps there is some justification in that. But the word that came back to us from multiple people we spoke to, which I wasn't sure if I should have believed at the time whether it was an excuse, but I am now starting to think it was credible, was the culture at London Colney, the culture inside the club. And okay, Mikel Arteta has worked very hard to improve that from the end of the Wenger reign, from the Emery reign when there were a lot of issues, and there are now issues still under him. And what we mean by that is that Arsenal have almost endemically become used to a way of working, to a way of operating, to certain standards. We've talked before how in the past, London Colney was seen as like a zen, like a spa, where the criticism didn't breach the walls and it was a place that so many players wanted to play. But from people inside, I hear that there needs to be cultural change. They need to get out of this comfort zone. They need to change the mindset and push each other in a way that hasn't been happening for a number of years now. And that doesn't just happen overnight. That is going to take time and is going to need patience. And those are two qualities that people don't want to hear. And it's not nice for many people when you've got used to working in a certain way, when people come in and shake it up. Some of the players, many of the players and staff didn't like some of the methods that Unai Emery brought in. Others thought and still do think that that was the right way to go. Some of his methods were working well. And it may be similar with Arteta. There's been friction, as we've reported. Go back to the podcast in February when we talked about Matteo Guendouzi's incidents in Dubai on the warm weather training camp. And then they continued in the following months. He ended up leaving on loan interestingly scored a wonder goal for Hertha Berlin the weekend. We reported the altercation between David Luiz and Dani Ceballos, which, yeah, you could say these things happen, but it gives us a little bit of insight into the tension, some of the issues inside. My goodness, it's a huge job for Mikel Arteta, and that's the context that you maybe look at things and say, did he really need to be promoted to first team manager when his job really essentially is to train up that first team to improve their results?
And just one more on Arsenal then. What is going on with William Saliba?
Well, I mentioned there that an issue with Ozil is the training, obviously. And we can apply that to the likes of Sokratis, who's also not in the squad, and William Saliba. Because, yeah, he's training. Mikel Arteta has talked about how he's made massive developments, I think the quote was, last week, in recent months. I do hear that he has stepped forward in the view of Arteta and the technical staff. But it seems that they do not believe that he's ready to figure. He can't figure in the Europa League for now because he wasn't named in the squad. He can figure domestically, but he seems to be pretty low down the pecking order. Now, there's a few reasons for this. The background we all know about. He was sent back on loan after signing for 30 million euros in 2019 to Saint-Étienne for the season. The plan was that he would play, he'd get up to speed, he'd continue his development. Well, he got injuries, then COVID struck, then he suffered a family bereavement, and then he came over. That was not ideal preparation. He starts training with the first team. They don't feel he's ready at the beginning of the season. They've got a huge number of centre-backs. Options. Even then, Gabriel new signing, David Luiz, Rob Holding, Shkodran Mustafi. Since then, players have come back to fitness. Callum Chambers, Pablo Mari, who was given a four-year contract. I've named just six there. Sokratis, seven, wasn't even in the squad. And then you get a 19-year-old who's learning his way in a new country. Many Arsenal fans are apoplectic about this. They think it is unforgivable that he's not playing. Well, you've got to remember that Mikel Arteta wasn't the coach that signed him, and that could be a factor in the equation as well. There's no kind of loyalty there. And yeah, sorry, going back to that Ozil point, in training, he is working with the first team when they're around, but often, as I said, when they're preparing for matches, he'll be on the opposition team. When they're not around, he'll be working with players like Ozil, Mustafi, and whoever else is left out of the squad, plus the under-23s. That's not conducive to getting ready for matches. I don't think you would say that Arsenal's central defence has been their biggest concern this season. If you look at the statistics, even yesterday's match, it's not like they desperately need Saliba in there. And it all leads to the fact of, well, what's going to happen then? And there have been reports that he can leave. Well, that's not my understanding. Arsenal are actually quite positive about the trajectory. They believe that he will come good, and they recognise the need for him to get game time. The likes of Luiz, Shkodran Mustafi and Sokratis are out of contract next summer, so that potentially gets rid of three obstacles in Saliba's path. The club then want him to come in and vie for position. So what happens in the meantime? Well, I think there's a good chance he'll be loaned out in January. His preference, as I understand it, is to go on a loan move within the UK and get up to speed in the football of this country before coming back to Arsenal. If that's not possible, or if Arsenal don't want it, then there are plenty of options in France, as there were before the transfer window shut in the summer, when Arsenal decided in the final days that he could leave on loan. There were options in the Premier League and in France. A deal back to Saint-Étienne again was lined up. And criminally, in my opinion, the paperwork wasn't completed in time. They ran out of time, and he then remains at Arsenal, is not named in the Europa League squad, and it makes for a very awkward situation. But I am optimistic that it will come good for Saliba and Arsenal at Arsenal in the not-too-distant future.
OK, plenty more in David's column for you to read over at The Athletic, include how Wolves plan to replace Raul Jimenez whilst he recovers from injury. Next upon the pod, we'll discuss Paul Pogba. Let's move on to Paul Pogba then. There's a big read on The Athletic that delivers the inside story on his time at United. One of the writers involved is, of course, The Athletic's United man, Laurie Whitwell, who has tried to cheer himself up from watching the derby by watching three Christmas films in one day. Did it work?
As we were saying off air, Christmas Chronicles 1 and 2 were rare, were delights, were surprising. Yeah, I enjoyed them. So, yeah, check them out.
And then he brought himself back down to earth by going and watching the United under 23s, right?
Yes. Well, that was earlier in the afternoon.
That was good.
And that was actually, yeah, the most entertainment all weekend, to be fair, because, you know, it was proper derby stuff, a red card, you know, meaty tackles, four goals. Yeah, great stuff.
It's my dog you can hear in the background. I might go and try and put the derby on demand on Sky, and then it'll put her to sleep. Let's just deal with the derby then, because you were there at Old Trafford, weren't you?
Yeah.
There are no fans, obviously, at the moment. I'm not going to go political, but there are no fans at the moment in Manchester at any games. So did that contribute to just how garbage it was?
Probably the biggest contributing factor is the 6-1 against Spurs from early in the season. And since then, Solskjaer has set his teams up against, you know, Arsenal, Chelsea, now Man City in these big games where he doesn't want to lose them and, you know, keep it tight. And, you know, it's going to be a game of fine margins. Obviously, against Arsenal, it went the wrong way for United with Pogba's foul, whereas against City, the one chance that City had, De Gea did pretty well, but it was, you know, minimal apart from that. Personally, this is going to sound really weird and warped, but I kind of enjoyed it being there. I don't know. I know this didn't transmit on the TV, and I know I'm in a minority. Even the people that were there were saying you're talking rubbish. I'm not trying to be sort of too, you know, studious and you know, pupil of the game by suggesting that it was an interesting sort of, you know, tactical sort of battle. But I don't know. I saw quite a few things going on that were kind of proper counters in a derby, off sort of off the ball maybe. And yeah, it wasn't. I just
like
thought,
what, like what? Come on, Laurie.
Little moments where I thought, you know, so, you know, building out from the back or pressurising City's team. And listen, I know that's not what people pay the money for. They want to see goals. They want to see chances. They want to see nice, you know, passing moves. But I just felt that given the way United have played against City in previous times, obviously they beat them at the Etihad last season, they beat them at Old Trafford last season, but the way that they did it was a bit more back to the wall, definitely enjoyable, and they could control without the ball. But I just felt that at least on this occasion, you know, they had a good amount of possession, which
there's
is
your
David,
soul
quiz.
David,
there's your
David,
soul
David.
Shot. Exclusive right. Interview sorted, Laurie.
I'm just going to go and hit my head against a wall.
I'm not getting involved in this one.
Well, you do the first Pogba question whilst I just got hit my head against it.
Bye, Chappers.
Laurie, Paul Pogba, I'm going to play Chappers. Are you alive?
Yeah. That sounds like it really hurt.
It did. On a serious note, Paul Pogba, my goodness, this is Manchester United, and you feel it's kind of pretty unbecoming that they're involved in this public war of words, you could say, although maybe they're not. It's more one directional at this point in time. But how have they got themselves into this? And was it kind of a problem of their own making from the moment they brought him back from Juventus, or was it under Jose Mourinho that it started to go wrong?
Yeah, I think that's what we were trying to figure out with the piece that we did this week. Very much appreciate the help from Andy Mitten, from Adam Crafton, and from Tom Worvell on the stats. But I think the issues were that, you know, the way he left the club, and Adam Crafton got a really good interview with Paul Pogba's first agent, Gael Mahe, who described the moment that he met Pogba and then the fact of Mina Raiola coming onto the scene. And he gave some really interesting quotes about the fact that he felt that when Ferguson first signed Pogba, he showed a real paternal instinct with him. He showed him, you know, around Carrington, and was very asking questions about him as a human being rather than as a footballer. And obviously, when Raiola came on the scene, he wanted him to, you know, have more game time, and I think Pogba did as well. But he felt that the best move was to take him away from United, go to Juventus. And Gael Mahe actually said that he would have kept him at United, and there was even talk when he first joined of staying at United as a one club player for the whole time. He said that by leaving and then coming back, that changed the dynamic for Pogba. So rather than a kind of kid that they developed themselves and brought through, there was a little bit of, I suppose, antagonism in the situation, albeit he was very happy when he came back. We've got some detail on the day that he signed for United and the video that they produced, and how happy and smiling he was, even though some of the pictures he was asked to pull a sort of brooding face. And I sort of wonder whether, you know, that kind of more replicates his time at United than the kind of smile. But and I think that the dynamic changed when he came back. You know, we spoke to some people that suggested that Ferguson would never have re-signed him, and certainly with Raiola in the picture, you can well imagine that being the case, given how strong Ferguson's come out against Raiola in little moments. And I think it just made him, you know, he was a world record signing when he came back, so the expectation was there, rather than someone as an academy product coming through, you know, being developed and sort of in the, you know, in the hearts of fans. It was a slightly different dynamic, and maybe that was always going to be the case. Now, clearly, when he first first, you know, play for United. It did well in the 2016-17 Europa League run, but it did disintegrate with Jose Mourinho. And we point out, I don't think it's necessarily a new revelation, but the fact that when Pogba won the World Cup with France, the comments that Jose Mourinho came out with afterwards were kind of critical rather than celebratory in terms of Pogba doing well, because it was an isolated tournament and he had no distractions outside and it was a very clear objective to obtain. And listen, maybe Jose has kind of been proved right in hindsight, but at the time it certainly caused a fragmentation in their relationship.
Where is this antagonism then? Because, you know, we've spoken about this a few times. United at an exec level, as I understand it, were quite happy to bring him back and pay that money, because all of a sudden you're signing a superstar and commercially that might be a better prospect than bringing someone through the ranks. I mean, so for example, bringing Pogba back, you sell more shirts than if you change Mason Greenwood's shirt number, for example.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, the commercial pull was a major factor, and I think you can see with the, you know, hashtag Pogback, they embraced it from the get-go. They weren't trying to hide away from the fact that this was a guy they were, you know, returning to the club who they let go for next to nothing. But I think it just sort of it changed the dynamic in the expectations of fans and his own expectations of what he could do or the status that he should have. So the kind of aspect of United, did they build a team around him or didn't they? You know, at Juventus he had talent around him, at France he does. Did he have that at United, or should he be expected to have that at United? That was always the debate, wasn't it? Well, you know, United have paid £89 million for you. You can go and win matches on your own, and that never really happened. So I suppose that's what I mean.
It's all very well, former United players from 15, 20 years ago, comparing how their careers was and what their dressing room was like to now. But it's a very different world now. And so how does this dressing room, this United dressing room, to react to everything that goes on around Pogba? Because he seems a very popular guy in that dressing room.
That was one of the points that was made to us. You know, you had Paul Scholes talking about, would Harry Maguire not take him to one side and say, you know, this is not becoming, you know, can you tell your agent to shut up? I'm sure there will have been some, you know, moments of kind of, you know, honest conversation, but I think, as you write, Chappers, that Pogba is actually a light guy in the dressing room. He's not someone that, you know, people are kind of frustrated by on a regular basis, that they actually like him as a person. At the time, and obviously was very awkward, and there's some debate about whether Pogba actually knew it was coming out, what Raiola said was coming out on the eve of a game. I suppose that's up to him, and his, only his teammates can, you know the full truth of that. But as a guy, I think he's actually quite popular, and you could see, I mean, Solskjaer picking him against City was very much a case of, right, you're our player, you know, go and perform. But also I think they, you know, he knew what he was going to get from him, having seen him on the training pitch and spoken to him personally. And then obviously Pogba sort of had a little bit of a comment on his social media channels. I mean, United did want him, I think, to put something out immediately to reset the kind of narrative around it. And the silence was deafening, to be fair. But at least he sort of said something now in terms of commitment, albeit, you know, very much on the pitch. You know, I will be performing, you know, without any kind of, you know, long-term sort of faith to the club, which is understandable, really, given his situation.
Laurie, two quick questions to finish with. Is Paul Pogba going to go if you were to stick your neck on the line, and when? And secondly, why don't Man United stop dealing with Mino Raiola? Are his clients now and going forward so important to them? The last I heard, he had split with Jesse Lingard, so I don't think there is any link between him and United other than Pogba. We know you have to dance with the devil in this sort of world, but there are many other good players and agents in the world that some would say negate the need for Raiola.
I think everyone's looking at a summer exit. You know, it's just a case of getting a club, you know, to either pay the amount of money, or, you know, maybe a swap deal does look more likely given...
It has to be a good swap deal, and I think Man United would want money as well for that.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, the Paulo Dybala stuff was kind of mooted in Italy. That was, you know, and that made sense to me, just given the fact that United had previously spoken with him or for him. Ronaldo's another one, which would obviously, you know, massively appeal to the fans as well as, I'm sure, the commercial guys at United. But they're also complicated, aren't they? You know, when you get into swap deals, and United did sort of pour a little bit of cold water on the Dybala stuff. So I just think that if you get into a stage where, you know, you've got this constant sort of aggravation, you know, going on, Solskjaer, I'm sure, would like to come to a satisfactory conclusion where he can get players that are 100% committed to the club, you know, fully wanting to play and see their futures at the club. So that's the way I see it going. But yeah, I think January's too soon. And in terms of Raiola, yeah, listen, I'm sure United would love to just sort of cut the cloth and, well, cut the cord rather, and not have to deal with him, because it, you know, his mode of operating is so, you know, difficult to deal with. But, you know, he's got Erling Haaland, and, you know, they obviously feel bruised from that encounter. That the suggestions that that episode did, you know, cause a real severance of relations. But Haaland is a player that, you know, United have tracked and Solskjaer definitely wants. So, you know, how much do you sort of weigh that into the equation? It's a difficult one, and he's got a lot of other players as well, Raiola. Listen, I'm sure, as, you know, Gary Neville said, you know, they should stop dealing with him. Absolutely. That, you know, in an ideal world, fantastic. But, you know, he's a guy that's got a vast scouting network that picks up a lot of players when they're very young. And, you know, so to kind of say we're never going to deal with him again is probably naive, I think.
Cheers, Laurie.
Thank you. Nice one.
Go and enjoy watching a 0-0 again, or whatever you want to do.
Well, I've actually got Match of the Day 2 on, and it's Arsenal 0, Burnley 0 at the moment. So what happens in that game?
Whoa, wow, the excitement. Goodness me, you know how to live. Thank you.
See ya.
Living the dream.
And Laurie and the team's full piece on Paul Pogba is on The Athletic now. It is well worth a read. Right, next, David, you are going to talk to Raf about Upamecano, about Borussia Dortmund sacking their manager Lucien Favre, and whatever else has been going on in Bundesliga.
Yeah, and the fact that the main point of that is that Manchester United look like they will not be signing Deo Upamecano is probably a good point for you to bow out, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I mean, it couldn't be getting much worse at the moment. Brilliant. Thanks for that. Right, I'll leave David to talk to Raf.
So straight to Upamecano. This is the top item in my column this week, and it involves his future, which appears at this point to be leaning towards Bayern Munich. We know how things can change. Until very recently, it was sort of relayed to us that there were two main clubs in the frame, Bayern Munich and Manchester United, but it's my information that United have made it clear that they won't be pursuing this. Their interest has cooled. Their targets for a centre-back next summer lie elsewhere. And so that would appear to leave Bayern Munich firmly in the driving seat. There will, I'm sure, be some other options too for such a high-quality player, young, with huge potential still, a relatively low release clause next summer at €42 million, and the expectation is that he would like to get this situation sorted sooner rather than later to sort of put himself firmly in the frame for France's World Cup qualifiers in March, and then, of course, the Euros in the summer. I'm now going to introduce somebody who knows far more about this than me. He worked on this item with me. It's our German football writer, Raphael Honigstein. Raf, welcome, and I think I'll kick off by asking you about Upamecano's potential destination of Munich. How long have they been interested in him, and do you think that's likely to happen?
Well, Bayern, as you might suspect, have had a keen eye on him for quite a while. He is playing in Leipzig, so they would have come up against him fairly often. And of course, Leipzig have a good record against Bayern. They're unbeaten in the last four Bundesliga games, and Upamecano has played a large part in that. So he's been on the radar. Up until a few months ago, the need for Bayern hadn't been this pressing in this position, because they have Pavard, who can play there, Lucas Hernandez can play there, there's Niklas Süle, there's David Alaba now, who's a centre-back, and of course there's Jerome Boateng. So lots of options. But with Boateng out of contract, and with Alaba also out of contract and likely to leave, there is both a need and a opening, if you will, for Upamecano. And I think it's only natural that Bayern should look at, you know, one of the best centre-backs in the Bundesliga, perhaps even in European football, show a keen interest and try to sign him. And the way things are panning out, it looks as if they have a decent shot at getting him.
Why, from your impression, having watched him pretty closely, might Manchester United's interest in him cool? They won't just react to one game, the game where he didn't do so well at Old Trafford. I'm sure they'll have been scouting him for an extended period of time. And there'll also be many other factors in these sorts of decisions as well. But how will United fans be reacting, and why potentially?
I don't know if that's a sporting assessment or if they looked at the transfer fee and all the add-ons and everything that goes with it and feel that he's not quite the kind of value that they're looking for. I mean, for a team that have spent a lot of money on their defence, you'd think that the price would be very tempting, and I'm sure they, you know, the fact that they've kind of ruled themselves out, or that we found out that their interest has cooled, would at least suggest that there was interest that was hot at some stage, or at least warm. If it's cool, it's gone cool now.
Yeah, we think there was contact between United and the various people involved. So they were there for sure.
Correct. So I think it's difficult to explain. I mean, it could well be that their scouts have looked at him and think that he is not quite the finished product yet, that he still needs time to learn, that he is a little bit inconsistent still. And I think these are all valid points. But I guess Bayern and a lot of other clubs who are interested in him take the view that at 22, there is a lot of potential that you're getting. You're getting a lot longevity, and you're getting a guy that will undoubtedly improve, as centre-backs tend to do when they hit their mid-20s. So I think rather than looking at his early performances and, you know, maybe some one or two weaknesses as a problem, I think Bayern and others have looked at his age and think, if he is already this far as a 22-year-old, where will he be in 2-3 years' time? And I think that's where the appeal lies for Bayern. And in a functioning side, in a well-coached side, players tend to get better and tend to bring their potential to the bear. And I think that is the thinking here as well.
Well, from Bayern to Dortmund, and a situation that you will have been dealing with, the sacking of head coach Lucien Favre this weekend. It was a 5-1 defeat by Stuttgart. I don't know, when I saw that result, it felt like it was a case of when, not if, he was going to go. However, some I've spoken to said that Dortmund were really hopeful they would be able to get through to the summer before making this change. So was it unexpected on the grander scheme, or was it completely expected by the time it happened?
It wasn't the plan, of course. The plan, as you said, was to go through the season with him, but there was absolutely no real desire to prolong his contract beyond the summer. His contract would have been up. And I think that shows you that there were some fundamental issues with him. I think you might even call it sort of a bit of a cultural misfit, where him as a character, also his football, was never the perfect match for what Dortmund were really looking for. But the results were just good enough to persist with him. And last year, and perhaps even the year before, Dortmund were very bereft of any real alternatives. They had the same problem that Bayern had before they stumbled upon Hansi Flick, that they just couldn't think of anyone else. So that's why Kovac was in the job for as long as he was. That's also why Lucien Favre was as long in the job as he was. Now, I think there is a plan in place for his succession for the summer. I think they will go for Marco Rose. It's been widely reported that he has a release clause that can be triggered at Borussia Mönchengladbach in the summer. And the big question is now with Edin Terzic, the assistant coach, coming in as a caretaker, is that enough, and will that work until the end of the season, or will Dortmund be forced to make another interim decision if indeed there is an agreement, or there can be an agreement reached with Marco Rose? So it's a very difficult position to be in, and I'm sure that Dortmund would have liked to see out the season at least make this transition period a lot closer or shorter than it will now turn out to be.
Yeah, I've spoken to people who have also mentioned Rosa as being the firm favourite, dismissed the likes of Pochettino. Interestingly, it's been suggested to me that it's not impossible that Dortmund might try to form a bit of a double act in the way that we've seen at Dortmund and especially at Bayern in the past with Rosa and potentially Max Eberl coming in as sporting director. Is that pie in the sky, or could that be a possibility?
So I asked my colleague Christoph Biermann about this in the Steigkast pod, which you can also listen to, of course.
Nice plug. I love it.
And he felt that was very, very unlikely to happen, that Eberl is, to all intents and purposes, Mr. Gladbach these days. Mm-hmm. And if he were to be lured away or, you know, persuaded to try something else, then Bayern Munich, his former club, might be the only destination that he would go for. So I can understand why Dortmund perhaps feel that he is the right guy to succeed Michael Zorc, if Zorc is indeed moving upstairs in a year or two as sporting director, because he also has had a real good talent in spotting players at the right time for the right price. But I think sort of on an emotional level, also perhaps on a political one, it'll be very difficult to get him out of Gladbach at this point.
You mentioned spotting players for the right time at the right price. The likes of Sancho, Erling Haaland, Gio Reyna, the list goes on. And somebody said to me last night, they cannot believe that Dortmund suffered a defeat like that and are going through what they're going through with some of the talent at their disposal. Do you think this presents a realistic risk that they could lose some of that talent, I think immediately from a British perspective, to Sancho? Or do you think they'll be quite confident of keeping them together?
The fallout for the players and the team as a whole is limited.
Yeah.
The team, I think, no longer believed in Lucien Favre. And a manager coming in and having success, or a new manager coming in the summer with a new agenda, I think would probably make it easier to persuade players to stay, because the Favre reign had sort of run its course. But I think it's a wider point that needs to be made and is often slightly misunderstood. At Dortmund, but even in the Bundesliga on the whole, managers do not buy players.
Yeah.
So there's not a case that Lucien Favre has come in and he's bought all these youngsters and now he's gone, they all want to follow him. These players would have been bought by the club. Favre, of course, would have had some input, but these are long-term targets that Dortmund would have persuaded for years and years, completely independently of who the manager is. And they would have signed up knowing that Lucien Favre might not be there forever. So it doesn't quite have the same, you know, it's his player, he signed the player kind of dynamic that traditional, I say traditional because I think it's already changing in the Premier League as well, but traditional Premier League managers used to have. And that's why the changeover in manager doesn't have that much of an impact on the squad planning, which makes sense, because every time a manager changes, you don't want to rip up the script and start again. You know, buying all the players that he wants, because he might be gone in 2 years' time as well.
Last but not least, your exclusive interview with Bayern's Leon Goretzka, which our listeners can read over on The Athletic. Give us a little taste of what's in that piece.
So, I mean, I think Leon Goretzka is a fascinating character. On the pitch, you know him as this really muscular, in the literal sense, box-to-box player who has bulked up and who's really been starting to dominate Bayern's midfield after taking some time from his move from Schalke in 2018. But now he's fully arrived. He's fully become part of the leaders, both for Germany and the club. And he talks about that added responsibility. He talks about his personal changes. He used the time during the corona break to really optimize his body, if you will, but also start thinking about other things that are important to him. He talks a lot about his foundation that he and Joshua Kimmich set up to help institutions and individuals who suffer from the fallout of the coronavirus pandemic. And he also talks quite movingly about visiting the Dachau concentration camp memorial just outside Munich. Wow. Which is a matter very close to his heart. And it's unlike a footballer, really, to go there on the day off and then post about it and be so, you know, vocal about it on social media. So all these things, I think, made for a hopefully, at least it was to me, a really fascinating interview with one of the more conscientious players in European football these days.
Please go and read that. Raf, thanks very much for your time. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week. Thank you.